I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Made in France since 1925, the first and finest enameled cast iron cookware and a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's lecreuset.com.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian foods. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on a dish or aspect of Asian cuisine by having a conversation with the passionate people from the world of Asian food. First of all, happy Halloween, everyone! Mm-hmm. It's a spooky episode. Just kidding. Today, we're joined by Lucas Sin, chef of Gen Z Kitchen, and Emily Kang, founder of Tomorrow, to talk about how they are changing the perception of Chinese takeout in the city with their fast casual concepts. They're saying goodbye to the iconic but greasy American Chinese takeout container. And to put it in New York fast casual comparisons, their concepts are ushering in a new age of, say, Chinese dig-ins and sweet greens. Will accessibility and speed to delicious Chinese food bring a better understanding of Chinese cuisine to the masses? We'll discuss whether a simple and humble thing like takeout can drive the education of Chinese culture. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
So we're just going to jump right into it. Lucas, let's start with you. How did you end up as chef of Gen Z Kitchen?
I wish I had the short answer for that. But
no, take your time.
I'd been cooking for quite a while. I'd actually opened my first restaurant back in Hong Kong when I was 16.
That's crazy. Where did you learn to cook?
Probably my father. My grandmother was a cook, but I think my father is probably the best chef I've ever met in my whole life.
Like a home chef or a professional?
Yeah, absolutely. Chef. So wow. Like you wake up in the morning and everything in the fridge that was there last night is suddenly in a pot and it's delicious. Like that's my dad. So we've been cooking at home for a while, and there in Hong Kong there's a bit of a culture of what we call sifangcai, or like private kitchens. So in Hong Kong we opened one of these things. And we did we were so silly and so stupid. We were taking ourselves way too seriously. A bunch of 16-year-olds opened a 13-course place that we ran every summer.
So as you and some friends?
Yeah, I taught a bunch of friends how to cook, how to hold three plates at once, how to talk about wine and that sort of thing. And before you know it, we're taking ourselves way too seriously, and I haven't really stopped cooking since. But I did a lot of my culinary training in Japan, where I used to think that the best food in the world was. Now that belief seems to have shifted to China. But when I met the other founders of Genza in 2015, we set off on a mission to build accessible Chinese food and to, as you said, bring Chinese food to the fast casual format. So we've been working on that project since.
Yeah. So what was the origin story of the concept? How did the other founders come up with it?
Right. So Genza started in New Haven probably sometime around 2013 to 2015. The concept in the beginning was They were thinking about how contemporary Chinese people are eating, both in China as immigrants here in the U.S. And they were asking themselves whether the food that we had access to in the U.S. while they were in school was a true representation of the lifestyle and the type of eating that they were accustomed to. And to some degree, it was yes, but to most of the degrees, it was no. So they started asking themselves, like, what would it be like to build a contemporary Chinese restaurant that is almost as Chinese as it is American? How would we build a restaurant that would reflect the narrative and the identity that we've come to see ourselves in? So that's how we settled on the fast casual concept. The idea there is to innovate in the content, but to keep the form and the structure of the restaurant the same. So the form and the structure, by that we mean, at Junzi, what we serve is Northern Chinese food in an assembly line, so you can build your own, very much like Sweetgreen or Dig In, as you mentioned. But the flavors and the menu and the food itself came from the Northeast and Northern China. So we were sourcing these flavors that were very much a part of our founders' childhoods, as well as, like, there's a little bit of a sense of nostalgia there.
Mm-hmm. So you guys decided on, so like Northeast Chinese style cuisine, mm-hmm. right? How did you go about building that menu? Because you said you're not from the Northeast China.
Yeah, I'm originally from Hong Kong. The reason why we decided to settle in Northern Chinese food because, well, the first step is that Northern Chinese food is kind of, in some ways, an easier way to explain the difference between the food we make and the food that most Americans know and have grown to love.
Mm.
Most of the Chinese food that you would have eaten today in the U.S. Is sourced, well, really it's a regional Chinese-American food, but it's sourced primarily from the South. There's a lot of stir fries that are based on things like soy sauce, cornstarch, sugar, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. frying or parboiling before you actually do the stir fry, that sort of thing. We decided that we had to bring some sort of flavor that was different from that so that we could tell people that there's more color and there's a little bit of diversity to Chinese
food.
And
it's not all rice. It's not all stir fry.
Absolutely. So, at Junzi, we don't serve rice. And we have decided to build the menu primarily based on the grain of wheat. In the North for a very long time, basically until the Cultural Revolution, there wasn't a lot of rice being grown. And most of the communities in Northern China had built themselves on the manipulation of flour. And so flour plus water is bing. So mm-hmm. all of bing basically is just flour and water made into
And how do you explain bing in English?
There are a couple of levels. The easiest way to say it's kind of like a Chinese flatbread. But as long as it's flat and like circular, it really falls into the category of bing. And as long as the main constituents of that the product are flour or dough based, that's certainly what a bing is. To give you an example, scallion pancakes, traditionally translated as pancakes, could very well be translated as scallion bing.
Mm-hmm.
In China, we like to call pizzas pizza bings because to us it's just flour and water with cheese and tomatoes and stuff on top. So it really is a pretty broad category.
Pizza bings.
Yeah. I mean, now in New York, for example, you can see a lot of bings like jambing. Mm-hmm. Jambing is exactly. Mung bean flour and water. There are some contemporary restaurants that are serving things called bing breads at Momofuku, for example. And bing breads is just, it's the Chinese flatbread.
Yeah. And so there's a ton of history to that product,
yeah,
right? And then also how it can transform then into mm-hmm. noodles and other mm-hmm. versions of it.
Yeah. So if you were to dig a little deeper into the original dictionary, around the Qin Dynasty, you'd have, since the Qin Dynasty, you would have found a dictionary definition of
And when
bing.
Was that? I'm not good at Chinese history, but like how many
this
thousands
is the first
of
dynasty.
Years?
This is... I wish I could give you a straight date, but this is something that I would refer to my father as well. But the first Chinese dictionary, right? You would go into the definition for bing, and it would say bing is food. And that would be the whole definition.
Wow.
Because for a very long time, flour and water, that dough, was the origin of a lot of the main carbohydrates that people survived on. So if you had flour and dough, right, and you rolled it out really flat and you toasted it and you put things into it, that could be a bing. If you rolled it out flat, raw, and you put minced meat in it and you wrapped it up really nice and small, that's a dumpling. If you took that big round ball of dough and went over a pot of water or something, you shaved it into the water, that's your like original noodle. You could carry this dough under your saddle. You could like go places nomadic tribes had it. So that really was like the sort of like cornerstone of a lot of the diet of China.
So transformative.
Yeah. It's a really, really ancient thing. You know, the other day, they found a 4,000-year-old noodle in like an urn in China, which means that we've been making noodles for 4,000 years. That's ridiculous. That's so long. Like, that's how old the Bing must have been older than the noodle, right?
Yeah.
Because the noodle came after the Bing. So, I mean, in some ways, yeah, we're referencing this like super old tradition, this super old way of preparing flour and water. But at the restaurant, what we like to do is we serve Chun Bing. It's kind of like a spring Bing. That's usually eaten on the first day of spring. The idea is you have these thin pancakes, thin Bing rolls, things, and then you add whatever vegetables, pickles, meats that you want into it, customize it, you have a little roll of your wrap, and that's the Chun Bing.
Yeah, it's easy to take out. But beyond the Bing and noodles that you guys offer, I also saw that you have the chef's table and after hours concepts. Can you describe those and why you do them?
Absolutely. So in the evening and during late night, we like to serve something called Junza After Hours. And Junza After Hours is our attempt to flip the entire restaurant the other way around. It was because when we first started working this project together, I was doing pop-ups in my dorm room. I made a lot of things like, you know, burgers and quesadillas and nasty mac cheeses and stuff for students. And but as nasty as that food was, there was a sense of community to eating late night and having students come together and celebrate, and we're making drunk food and all these things.
Yeah, more of that community aspect of the culture.
And as students, right, when we met as students, it made sense that we were trying to eat healthy, nutritional, like balanced food during the day. But at night, you wanted something that was more revelatory. So that's where the After Hours menu came about. That After Hours menu has evolved since we started doing it. Every location has, you know, like a slightly different menu. So it's been a lot of fun. Chicken wings, fried chicken, scallion pancakes, that sort of thing. As for the chef's table, which is another thing that we do at Junza, that's kind of my personal project of doing tasting menus that reflect or they attempt to explore some sort of narrative. So to give everybody a sense.
Must be interesting for you, too, because you come up with a different theme. Is it every month?
Every month. We do 7 courses for a small amount of guests, and they eat these sort of like courses while everybody else is eating the fast casual food. And every month, we pick a theme that explores the cusps of Chinese food culture. Most recently, we did one with, shout out Harlan Turkel, MHT on vinegar and looking at the relationship between vinegar and Chinese food. And we've done dinners that look at the relationship between Chinese immigrants and Dominican immigrants. And so it's all just to, again, like the way we used to do. We're taking ourselves way too seriously, but using food as right. like the vessel and the first step to access some sort of like deeper cultural narrative.
I read this Vogue article. You guys were described as the Chinese Sweetgreen in it. How do you like that comparison?
I mean, it's good because Sweetgreen is an incredible institution, and they very much were trailblazers for the new generation of fast casual concepts, especially in dining, especially in defining not only how metropolitan Americans dine and eat, but also how casual and efficient restaurants should be run. It was really funny when that story came out. The CEO of Sweetgreen, Nick, gave us a call, gave us a ring, and basically said, "Hey, can I speak to the person in charge here?" And we're like, "Hey, yeah, okay. What's up? Who is this?" And he was like, "Hey, I'm Nick." I was like, "Nick what? Nick from Sweetgreen." "Oh, the CEO of Sweetgreen."
Oh, yeah.
He says something along
that
the lines
Nick.
Of, "Yeah." He's like, "I've read that you're the Sweetgreen of Chinese food, so I guess we should talk." And then he's come to the restaurant a bunch, and I think he's a fan. So it's a very healthy connection, I think. And absolutely, in terms of Sweetgreen, I think they do a lot. They have done a lot already in the very short amount of time that they've been here in the U.S.,
mm-hmm. So it's kind of a model of success.
Absolutely,
that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so last time you were here, we were talking about Mala Project, mm-hmm. but this time we'll talk about tomorrow. But could you remind our listeners first how you ended up as a restaurateur in New York City?
Yeah, so I came to the United States to go for college at the Culinary Institute of America in 2010. primarily I just wanted to, I guess, pursue this culinary dream of mine. Didn't really know what to do after graduation, so I ended up becoming the general manager at a Chinese restaurant called China Blue. They're also the owner of Cafe China, which is, as of right now, the only one Michelin Chinese restaurant in New York City. So I've been idolized them ever since I came here and knew about them. After almost a year of working with them, my visa was coming to an expiration. So me and my coworkers at the time from China Blue, we were just casually chatting, and I was talking to them about my visa issue. Can't be on payroll for much longer. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, you could be, I found out that you could be a founder of a company. So if you wanted to do that, and it was kind of an impulsive decision. So we got together and we were like, maybe we'll just open our own restaurant.
Wow.
So that's where Mala Project came about. The first spark of inspiration.
Yeah, kind of like the rush of that was a good thing. It pushed you in the right direction.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And then going back to before coming to the U.S. to study, who or what inspired you to go down this culinary path?
So my grandma, actually everybody in my family is a really, really good cook, mm-hmm. except for my parents. So my grandmother, my aunt, my uncle, even my cousin, they're all really good cooks. So I think because of the fact that my parents didn't really cook that much, so like I always had this, I have to go out to get good food. So like we always go to my grandparents for dinner. So that became like a ritual rather than, coming home and like just have the food ready there. So I spent a lot of time with my grandma, and she pretty much raised me while my parents were working, and she influenced me a lot. And I had already forgotten about this actually growing up, but when I was little, this is my grandparents reminded me of this, because when I was little, I always wanted to be the a food critic.
Mm, okay.
But I forgot about that. And then after going to attending to CIA, my grandparents, they were like, "Oh, your childhood dream came true." And I was like, "I forgot about that."
Oh yeah, so okay, you've had this vision long term.
Yeah, I guess, but like I guess it's more like subconsciously. It was just always in me. But then even back in high school, I was baking. I was taking baking class really seriously. And I had, like, I even had my online bakery. I was doing a lot of baking and cooking mostly.
So where did the concept of tomorrow come from?
So after 2 years of Mala Project, I had this urge to do something else for my mom, essentially. So I wanted to open a small, like a tiny family small restaurant in New York, and I'll have this restaurant dedicated to my mom, because at Mala Project she has invested in me, and then we also had my really good friends as my partners as well. So I wanted to have like a small thing, just maybe I didn't think too much, maybe as a retirement fund for my mom. And I didn't want it to be big, so I was going for the takeout kind of like low maintenance concept. And the concept of tomorrow is kind of like a shitang, mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, a Chinese dining hall or like a
canteen.
Yeah, a canteen, cafeteria. That we have a lot of back in school, all the schools or like large companies that will have their own shitang. And I always liked that idea, so I wanted to do something similar to that, kind of like, and we're serving three dishes and the base.
Yeah, and like, it changes up every day?
Yeah, our menu changes every day. We have our lunch, like instead of having lunch ladies, we have our lunch, young girls, but it's a very, very casual, like, family-oriented place.
And can you describe some of the dishes on your menu at Tomorrow? What does that look like?
We have, so there are five staple dishes that we have every single day, and the rest 6 to 7 dishes we rotate. Some of the signatures are, there's the spicy or pig ear in chili oil, tomato and egg, which is what I grew up eating, beef and potato, like jiachangcai, really, really simple, homey
home-style
food.
Yeah, cooking. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Shout out to the tomato egg. You guys have one there at Gen Z too, right?
Everybody loves tomato egg.
Yes. And then what regions of China would you say these dishes are inspired by? Or is it across the board?
It's across the board with the heavy focus of northern Chinese food and some Sichuanese food. Even because I grew up in Tangshan, which is about 2 hours from Beijing, so I'm from the north. And even in my family, we would have Sichuan dishes like Mapo Tofu. Sometimes we would have Kung Pao chicken. So it's not, I think, like the actual, in a Chinese household, we don't really differentiate.
Yeah, it's like your favorites, much like here you can have like fried chicken from the south.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I guess you would say it's a combination of Beijing style and Sichuan style.
Sure. And you're serving up Chinese breakfast too, right? Which is pretty rare in the city. Can you describe to our listeners what kind of dishes are typical of Chinese breakfast?
Yeah, typically we have, I guess, very well-known doujiang youtiao, soy milk and fried dough.
A cruller?
Yeah, kind of like that. It's very greasy, like literally fried dough, and you dip it in soy milk and you drink it together. There's a lot of noodles, a lot of carb, like pork bao, congee with pork and century egg. So it's very carb heavy for our breakfast.
So really get going after that.
Yeah.
And what's the reception been like? What's your clientele like? Do you get more like Chinese, Americans?
When we opened, we had a majority Chinese, like Chinese immigrants, kind of like me, came to.
They know that they love the pig ears and chili oil, you know.
Yeah, they do. And then people that grew up in China, who work down in Feidai, and then slowly we've been seeing a lot more American, actually a lot more American customers now. And there's some American Chinese as well. So I would say now it's like maybe a 65% versus 35% American.
Cool. And they're really also receptive to the new dishes that they've never seen before?
Yeah, they are. Because it's very obvious that it's nothing like what they've seen before at a regular Chinese takeout. And some people that have been to China, they would come in and they'll look at our display, our steam table, and they'll say, "Oh, you guys are actually Chinese food."
Ah,
like,
okay.
Yeah, we are actually Chinese food. Yeah.
It's like, how refreshing.
Yeah.
Are there any similarities between Tomorrow and Mala Project, do you feel?
I think in the sense of the nostalgia, there's a lot of similarity, and we always we try to be as original as possible. We try to stay away from the word authentic because I think it's very subjective. But both at Tomorrow and Mala Project, we don't really like innovate. I guess we try to instead we try to represent the dishes as close as to what we've remembered it ever since childhood. So in that sense, there's a lot of similarities. I think the vibe, like, although one is full dining restaurant, one is takeout restaurant, a lot of people can they perceive this vibe as like comfortable and homey. Yeah.
And to the both of you guys, Lucas, Emily, how did you and your teams decide to go with a like fast casual concept right now for what you're doing rather than executing on a full service restaurant for this idea or the type of food you're serving?
I think Emily and I probably have different perspectives because she runs a wonderful full service restaurant to begin with. But the really weird thing that Genza decided to do was to open first a counter service fast casual restaurant. And the idea was because our primary motivation was accessibility. And so therefore that required for the food to be served at a certain efficiency, for people to be in and out of the restaurant, for the food itself to have a certain takeout ability and all of the rest. So we were looking at how people would like to eat lunch usually here in the US. And there are a couple of models at hand. There are diners, there are full service restaurants, there are sort of like fast food restaurants, and then there are those fun things in between that we now call fast casual. And looking at restaurants like that, we saw the sort of like operation efficiency and also the efficacy of like bringing people, bringing a large amount of people.
Food. Reaching the masses.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we decided that that's what we wanted to try to build, especially because there seems to be a little bit of a lack of Chinese food representation in that field. The titans that are Chinese sort of casual food right now are Panda Express and P.F. Chang's, both of which were built in the 80s. And they've done incredible, wonderful things. Panda Express, for example, has 2,000 units now. Which means a lot of people. They just opened two restaurants in Russia. That just means so many people all around the world are eating Chinese food and getting to know Chinese food because of that. Mm-hmm. And we thought we wanted to be the second wave and to follow their footsteps to say, hey, this is what a Chinese casual restaurant would be at scale if we built it in 2015 and not the 1980s.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm so glad you're doing that. All right, so we're going to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, the first to pioneer colorful enameled cookware over 90 years ago. They've been a favorite for generations through the meals and memories the cookware creates and the style it expresses. My name is Kat Johnson. I'm the communications director at Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food, and my favorite cookware is the 8-quart marine blue Dutch oven that never leaves my stovetop. Before we got our Le Creuset, the cookware we used most often was an antique Griswold cast iron pan. It didn't take long for me to realize how much I'd been missing enamel cast iron in my life. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron, but paired with the unparalleled performance and ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN, that's LECREUSET, .com/HRN to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
Welcome back. All right, so Lucas, Emily, why do you think it takes a younger generation to be doing what you're doing? You know, pioneering the Chinese fast casual concepts in the city and having a desire to do that.
I think it just happened to be the timing is right now. Our older, the generation before us, they have built a wonderful foundation for us, and they introduced this the first representation of Chinese food. They brought it over here, and tweaks they had to make, whatever like changes they had to make to have to build that bridge for locals to be able to access it easily. They did that, and now a lot of people have already had that knowledge, and now with the traveling is so much easier now. A lot of people are learning what real Chinese is on their own as well. So there's also that demand that's been, you know, people have been wanting it. Mm-hmm. So the timing worked out, and I think it's funny because our generation, or like maybe 5-6 years, the people 5-6 years older than us, they wouldn't be thinking about going to America and open a restaurant. They'd be coming to America.
It's what their parents told them not to do.
Exactly. They would come here and be in finance. They would come here and be engineers. But now with like people becoming more and more open-minded, and the perception of being a chef or like being in the hospitality industry, it has had so much.
Yeah, it's like, shifted.
Yeah, it's shifted, and the reputation is much better now. So younger people, younger kids are going to culinary school now.
Yeah, they see the opportunity.
Exactly. Okay. So yeah, it's working out like in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And what are some perceptions you feel like your concepts are, you know, already changing as it relates to New Yorkers' perceptions about Chinese food, Chinese culture?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is I think what the new generation, new cohort of Chinese chefs and Chinese restaurateurs is doing is adding to the diversity of Chinese food. It's a pretty simple statement of saying, oh, Chinese food is always going to be more colorful and more complicated than you think it is.
Mm. It's endless.
Okay. It's like...
You think you know Chinese food, but no, actually.
No, there's this. And then people, whoa, Chinese food can be so spicy and delicious. And you open a Sichuan place, and then some other person is going to come by and say, oh, there's this other type of Sichuan food. And then there's like a third type of Sichuan food. And then even within Chengdu, there's like East Chengdu, West Chengdu.
Yeah.
And so you start like opening all these doors. And I mean, that's the reason why I think Chinese food is the most exciting food in the world, because of how broad the horizons can be. And as young people start adding to this, I think what's been really great for New York is that New Yorkers have been super receptive to the different varieties of Chinese food. Mm-hmm. If you think about all the types of rice noodle restaurants that have just popped up in like the same block right around Mala Project, it's crazy because there's so much variation to it.
Yeah.
Everywhere that we open a restaurant, everywhere there's a new Jinzi, within the next 6 months, there are like four different types of noodle restaurants popping up all over the place near us.
Yeah, noodles, but all different.
All different types of noodles. Okay. Like, oh, I'm the lamb noodle place. This is like the beef noodle place. This is like the lighter noodle. This is the cold noodle place. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, and especially for New Yorkers who are always seeking something new, they like to be known as foodies.
Yes.
To have that access to... Yeah. The constant discoverability of food is exciting.
There's a density in New York, especially in Manhattan, that allows for this type of innovation. Mm-hmm. The other thing about New York is not only are they open to people bringing sort of like honest or directly imported, what we used to call authentic versions of dishes from China here to the New York, they're also super receptive to people who are, as Emily is saying, honest to themselves. There's a lot of like new cuisine that's coming up that is representative only of the chef and the restaurateur's own story.
Yeah.
And have you then therefore have these sort of like contemporary Chinese restaurants that couldn't exist anywhere in the world except for New York.
So going to take a look at, you know, your guys' menus, there's like rice, bings, and noodles. There's plenty of carbs there. Would you argue that this is accessible for the health conscious diner? And I ask this because, you know, there's like the sweet green arguing for the health aspect.
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think just refer to the conversation that I had with my mom during this trip. She, you know, carb is very important. And I was going on this no-carb diet, and she yelled at me. She said, carb is brain food.
As an Asian mom does.
Yeah, carb is brain food, and it's important for you. And there's a reason why, you know, you have carb, like a huge bowl of noodles and fried dough for breakfast. in a country with like 5,000 years of culinary background. So I don't think carb is like the devil here. The problem is
how it's marketed right now. So like it sounds like from the Chinese or traditional Chinese perspective, it is healthy to have carbs worked in your diet.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, I think it. I mean, all our Chinese mothers have always told us it's always about moderation and it's about balance. And I think one of the wonderful things about Chinese food is that idea of balance. That whenever you have a bowl of noodles, there will be some fiber and there will be protein and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that's. I mean, that's important to have. But the carb idea is one that's very. Close heart for us as Chinese restaurant owners because it's not just carbohydrates, it's also gluten, it's also soy and all these things, and sometimes they're allergies and sometimes you have to ask yourself to what extent is it my responsibility to educate our diners to say, hey, this thing you're saying about MSG is a little complicated. There are like multiple ways to attack this, and the same thing can be said for carbohydrates.
So what are some iconic Chinese things that you guys do at your restaurants that Chinese natives or immigrants would recognize and be delighted by?
I guess we have to talk about tomato egg, right?
Yeah, it's a tomato egg.
It's a tomato egg. It's I mean, I've had a tomato egg at Tomorrow that's like super delicious. And yes, it's tomato egg. And then you look at the tomato egg that we serve at Junzi. Yeah, that's tomato egg too. But they're kind of like really quite different in the.
Everyone has their own version.
Everyone has their own version. And what's funny is when I first put tomato egg in the menu back in New Haven, a lot of like American-born Chinese customers in particular would come in and like berate me for like making like tomato egg fusion dishes because they were like, oh, like tomato egg is like authentically served with rice, like the whole idea is this like goopy tomato sauce that you can like mix into your rice, like nobody eats it with noodles, nobody puts shrimp on it, like what are you talking about, like they don't gourmetify this like home style mom dish. I'm saying to myself, because I'm thinking of that moment when I decided to put tomato egg on the menu, which was when I was traveling in China. So I spent a month in China cooking every year to like sort of get ideas and see what's happening. And I was at the equivalent of a Best Western, I think, like a regular hotel breakfast. I'm sitting down, I'm looking at what's in front of me that I got from the buffet. And it's a bowl of tomato egg noodles, like soupy tomato egg noodles, like ban mian actually, instead of totally soupy. And there were little shrimps on it. And the person who served it to me had said, like, this is how, like, this is my breakfast every single day. A little bit of chili oil, shrimp, and like tomato eggs over noodles. I'm thinking about that moment as I'm in my restaurant and this guy's berating me for like, you know, making inauthentic tomato egg dishes. Like, this is like, there's a lot of work to be done. Like, the story is super complicated. And in the North, obviously, if they weren't eating rice, they would eat it with noodles. What else would you eat it with? So, I mean, the good news is most of our customers come in and they see the tomato egg and, you know, they think about the Francis Lam article in New York Times.
Or their childhood memories.
Or their childhood of the tomato egg. And like, wow. And the good thing is you can tell that people suddenly eat something and they have access to that nostalgia. Like, oh, this is what I need today when it's, you know, a little dreary or whatever it is.
It's funny because I actually grew up eating tomato and egg noodle as well, like da lu mian. Yeah. And we would put cucumber and vinegar and aged vinegar, garlic in it too.
Yeah.
Super delicious.
Yeah. And then I guess like also at your restaurants, you know, you have your menus in Chinese. You have decor that speaks to like Chinese traditions. I saw you got some like white rabbit candies at Gen Z.
That's a fortune cookie. Just the thing you give people to make people think about the experience a little bit.
Yeah, so the environment kind of like warms you to mainland China a little bit more, right?
Yeah, and we also started doing this WeChat group thing where we have our customers pulled into this one WeChat group where we post our menus every single day because it does change every day. Because WeChat
technology
is
how
everybody does everything now in China. Mm-hmm. So like having that be a part of the restaurant operation, it's also kind of creating this familiar, like nostalgic feel for them.
We need to be a part of this WeChat group.
Yeah, all the insider tips. Yeah.
Now it's gotten so big that it has to be invite only now.
Oh, wow.
Oh, what?
Let's hope we can invite.
That's how WeChat does it.
All right, so what do you guys think is needed to maintain a successful business model for each of you? You know, since we're talking about like the fast casual concept, what do you think the keys to success are?
I think staying true to yourself and staying true to your the most original idea while being able to keep up with the trend.
Yeah, not like copying something directly.
Yeah, exactly. But you also have to, we have to keep evolving, and as people are learning about Chinese food and as people are changing their perspective on Chinese restaurants, we have to keep involving ourselves. But at the same time, we have to try really, really hard not to be distracted by it. You know, why did we originally have a three dish and a base? Are we going to get rid of rice because now there's this whole like no carb fad that's going on? Like, no, we don't want to do that. But at the same time, it's very important to listen to the customers and like analyze why people do certain things. Like, why is certain things popular versus some others are not?
Yeah, maybe it's like you choose your battles, like which ones are the things you can educate on and which ones you need to kind of change with the tide.
Yeah, exactly.
One other thing that I can think of that I do very much believe in is that we have a responsibility as restaurateurs to educate our customers, yes, but also to educate the people that are making the food. In my perspective, at Zhenzi, a lot of our cooks aren't Chinese, and a lot of our cooks and the servers who serve the food didn't grow up with the type of Chinese food that we did. So we put a lot of effort into educating them into what contemporary Chinese food could be and what it's supposed to taste like, how it's supposed to be cooked, and why we are trying to do what we do. We employ so many people at Zhenzi that we have to make sure that they are a part of our mission and they understand our motivations, that we can do this together as well.
Right. That's what also makes it scalable. Absolutely. From a business perspective. So what are your goals for your respective eateries in the next year?
Well, Jen's is opening our fourth restaurant by Bryant Park early next year.
Yes.
And we just started construction. So that's quite exciting and daunting, but we're pretty excited about that. And we're going to be, as the operations of the restaurant continue to expand, so will our capacities, hopefully, for storytelling at least. So I'm personally, as the chef of the restaurant, really excited to just start branching out into other types of Chinese food and learning more about Northern Chinese food that I absolutely couldn't imagine that I would have known before.
That's exciting.
We're also trying to, I guess, expand tomorrow at a very, like, I guess, doable way. So Lucas was saying before, the one restaurant, the influence that you have is so limited. So if you do want to educate people at a much larger scale, you would have to expand. And that's why, like, that's how the takeout restaurant came about, because it's so, like, it's lightweight, it's easy to, it's more scalable. So we're going to try to do that. And then at the same time, get our team ready. Because another big, really big part, I guess, for both Junzi and us, is to educating the people that are with you and have them be ahead of, you know, they have to grow faster than the business itself. So, like, educating the people, making them great leaders while we're trying to grow the business together.
Yeah, that's great. So beyond food, you're thinking about your people too.
Yeah.
And where do you see yourself in a few years from now? Say, like, I know this is a hard one, like in 3 years.
The only thing I can think of is in 3 years, I really want to know how to make like something. Like, I really want to master stir-fried cabbage. I've been thinking about this dish for so long.
Oh,
I can't
get
it right.
Simple,
it sounds
not
so simple. These are the what we call like technique dishes. where you find yourself, you know, knees deep in Chinese culinary technique, and you're saying to yourself, "Well, I would really like to make the best fried cabbage I've ever had, just because that's how good I am on the wok." So, I mean, those are the short-term goals that you can keep as a chef to keep yourself, you know, going and alive and
seeking perfection.
Absolutely, yeah, sort of, less perfection. Just I just want to make the best cabbage like ever. Wouldn't that be so cool?
Yeah. That sounds also very type A of you.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
We try to be.
hopefully, I'm working on my MBA, and hopefully in 3 years I will be able to have that. Just because it's different for us, since it's a smaller scale company, and I have to be able to offer my team more than what they can get. So like there's that pressure of getting better myself so that I can give more back, learning new knowledge, learning more things about leadership style, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah.
And hopefully in 3 years we don't have to explain to people that
what
tomato
a
beanus
and, or
yeah,
what like, tomato.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the people will be accepting of the fact that you can do tomato and egg over rice noodle.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see that time.
That
I think
so
it'll
cool.
happen. All right, so before we end the program, we're gonna shoot off some quick fire questions. It's all fun food related questions.
Awesome.
So just share what comes to mind first.
Goodness.
Yeah. All right, when eating out, what neighborhood do you end up in the most?
I'm always in Chinatown. For whatever reason, because I think there's so much to be taken for granted at Chinatown. When you end up there and you really dig into the menu and you get to know the people who are making the food, it gets even more interesting than you thought it could be.
Love it.
I guess Greenpoint now, because I just moved here.
Yeah. What's your favorite restaurant in New York City right now?
The first one that comes to mind is Attaboy.
That comes
JP's
up a lot.
Abby's restaurant.
Go
oh
JP,
my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is the most talented chef. Like, oh my goodness, I like love that guy. I moved to New York like about a year ago, and I've been to that restaurant 10 times now. Because every single time it learned something new. I just respect everything they do at Attaboy so much. Not to mention Atomix.
I have so many, but the first thing came to mind at this moment is Kopitiam, new Malaysian restaurant, small, you know.
Yeah, they've been on the show before too.
Yeah.
So great. I'm so happy that they found a new location.
I know, me too. And the fact that how supportive the community is amazing to see.
Yeah. Also, Go Asian Breakfast, more options for that. Okay, what's your favorite food city in the world?
Chengdu, no doubt for me.
Yeah, I would probably say Chengdu as well.
Hong
Kong.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, probably.
Why? I want to just understand that a little bit more.
Because they have so many varieties in just different types of dish. You can never get enough of it. And the way that people enjoy food is... they're actually eating. They're
you like see them eat. Like
yeah, you
okay.
see them eat, and then they spend 2 hours at a skewer place, and then afterwards they go to have tea and
settle that stomach for more.
Exactly, and they have this whole like lecture about it because it cleanses you and like it scrapes all the oil, all the grease out of your body. It's great. They really know how to eat and how to live there.
Yeah, Chengdu has an amazing eating culture. At downtown, there's kind of like a Gucci temple. It's like a 3-story like all glass Gucci temple, and you like watch these people just like hanging out, like shopping for bags, and they just have like skewers in their hands, or like you know, they'd be like slurping
like
pig brain
Chengdu
noodles.
Only in Chengdu Gucci
like
would that be.
I
like...
know, it's just incredible. And I mean, it's a it's so huge, and like everybody in the sort of like Chinese culinary world respects Chengdu, but we always know that more stuff is going to come out of there.
All right, I got to put that back on my travel wish list. What's the best thing you ate recently? It can be out, at a restaurant, your restaurant, at home.
So I had Domino's Hawaiian pizza for the first time since they changed the recipe like this weekend.
Wait, is it better or worse?
It's been improved. Like this hand pan pizza. Well, they changed this recipe quite a couple years ago, and I've heard about this, but I haven't had it for a long time. It's delicious. It's so good. It's perfectly crispy. It's very consistent, like in the middle and the gooey middle to the side. There's a perfect amount of crisp. The pineapple is like julienned so beautifully. It's almost a perfect product.
Yeah, and I love that we're talking about Domino's at Roberta's.
Oh, yeah. Not too shout out.
For me, I last night I brought this cold dish from tomorrow. It's a pork belly with scallion, and it's cold. Oh. And then I had like brown rice, but then I didn't finish it, so I just stir fried them together, made it like a pork belly fried brown rice.
Good texture there too.
Yeah, very, very good.
Okay, amazing. Thank you for all the answers. That wraps up our show. Where should listeners go to follow you and keep up to date on what you're up to?
You could follow us on Instagram at Junzi Kitchen, JUNZI Kitchen. Or you could, if you're interested in coming to the tasting menus, you can DM me directly at lucas.sin.
You can follow us at Mala Project on Instagram. Also, Tomorrow NYC on Instagram as well. And my personal handle is Amelie Kang on Instagram.
Awesome. Thank you, guys. And listeners, thank you for tuning in. We truly appreciate your support. If you haven't already, please take a minute to leave us a star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks, that's November 14th, with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.